We're the Inspire Podcast. We're dedicated to bringing you the latest research in medicine, dentistry, veterinary medicine, and everything in between, from both students and academics, in a language everyone can understand.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Inspired Journal Podcast to stay up to date. Visit the journal's website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk to access original research and articles from students or find out about how you can get more involved.
In this week's episode, we're joined by Dr. Bilal Malik from the UK Dementia Research Institute at Cardiff University to talk to us about autophagy, neurodegenerative disease, and everything in between, of which there is plenty. Thank you for agreeing to come and chat with us today. I'm sure it's going to be very interesting. So if you'd like to, first of all, just tell us your name, where you're from in terms of institution-wise, and your area of specialty, first of all.
Yes, yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to talk to younger people, students especially. My name is Bilal Malik. I am currently based at the UKDRI at Cardiff University. And UKDRI is a very young, fresh facility that has been established to find cures for dementia. And I am in my third postdoc and currently also funded by Wellcome Trust to carry on my research in neuroscience. And my current work is to look for genetic modifiers which modulate autophagy as an intervention mechanism for dementia.
We'll get into that in a sec, but we talk about some of the more sciencey stuff. We just have some kind of fun questions mm-hmm. that we like to ask guests who we ask on to the podcast. So, do you have a favorite book that you've read in the past? I don't know how many books you read, but let's say 6 months, and then we can add months if we have to.
Yeah. So I think that my last favorite book was Purification of Soul. It has a religious relay, but it is quite scientific and psychological. So it gives you a rationale to think about yourself and think about your relationship with people around you and you know why you find a purpose for your life. So that's what I read in the last 1 year, my favorite book.
Okay.
Nice. I'm actually not a big reader. I've tried probably within the past year, I tried reading some more books, but I think I've only read one book in the past year, and that's probably also the only book I've read in the past 5, maybe even 10 as well.
Yeah.
So,
I am currently reading about understanding emotional intelligence. It has been written by somebody who works in HR, and it's a very case by case study of emotional intelligence. And the aim for writing this book for the author is really trying to highlight how important it is to understand other people's emotions, not really delve very deep, but at least so that you can have a healthy working relationship with them. It's a very interesting book. The author is Nielsen Keith and Francis Kay. It's a very interesting read.
Yeah, sounds like reading before bed.
yes, definitely.
Better than some of the papers on autophagy, I'm sure. Although they might be able to send you to sleep better.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, it's funny. I think the relationship of sleep with reading changes with time. When you are a student doing your undergrad or a master's degree, you read about stuff that you're supposed to read and it will send you to sleep. But when you reach a stage where you're carrying out advanced research and you're responsible for these projects, reading actually doesn't send you to sleep. It wakens you up because you want to not miss, important information that might be in the papers. And you're always trying to find links of, you know, how the paper, for example, what you're reading or any article or a book, how that relates to your work. So you're constantly thinking, and thinking, you know, actively is always it's going to inhibit going you to sleep. So yeah, I think that the relationship of reading is dependent on what you're reading. But yeah, that's why I'm reading about emotional intelligence.
I think there's probably like a, I can think of like a graph where you can plot like ideal bedtime books, where you want a book that's challenging enough that you're going to read it, but not so challenging that you're going to be kept up for hours just mulling it over. I read the book that broke my reading drought was Life Awakening by Nick Law. Life Ascending. And I found with that I would kind of get into bed at night and start reading it, and I couldn't stop. Like, I would just keep reading, and it was kind of getting to the point that I was like, I want to actually read more and more, but I need to go to sleep. But yeah, it's definitely not one of those books that occupies the middle ground. Yeah. But yeah. Speaking of sleep.
Sleep hygiene is becoming a very common term in scientific circles these days.
Yeah, it was a big discussion in our psychiatry block about sleep hygiene and how to you're just on mental well-being as a student, not necessarily as a patient either. So it was an interesting conversation.
Yeah. I think like sleep hygiene is like such a big, especially I think currently with like mental health, and it's all over social media. But I think, you know, you're told all a bunch of things and you just don't know how to follow it. And then as students, I think there's a balance that you must strike, I feel, from like sleep hygiene.
Yeah, you must be interested in what I just heard on the radio. In Bristol University, they kind of didn't have a systematic way about going about it, but what they did is they tried to teach students being happy. They said it was not based on any scientific advice, but what they did is they talked about happiness, and they talked about being aware of happiness, and they talked about kind of not getting used to certain things which would make you happy otherwise. And they saw that the outcome of these students in their academic performance improved significantly. I don't know what significant level they have achieved, but they said, so it's the same for sleep. There's a lot of advice around there, but you can adopt and follow the advice most of the time. But there are times, especially in students' lives, for example, during exams, you just can't fall asleep.
Yeah.
You would want to sleep, but you just can't. And you feel like sleeping just before the exam time is like 1 hour away. So yeah, sleep is important. But it's also important because I'm interested in sleep and its role in my field of research.
I was about to say that, speaking of sleep, I think that nicely brings us on to, or maybe it brings us nicely on to, I guess that will be seen, autophagy. So can you just give us a sort of a Wikipedia intro sentence definition of autophagy and why it's important?
It's good you said that, because I should have actually gone to Wikipedia and found what they say about it. I use a very simple definition to introduce students to it, and it should be understandable by anybody. And I say this is basically a process by which cells of our body rid themselves of waste. And also, this is a way which helps cells deal with stress. And there is lots of things that are underneath both of those lines. But in simple layman's terms, you know, it helps our cells rid of waste, and you know, helps them live longer by that way.
What is the difference then between autophagy and like apoptosis? They sound very similar in the sense.
The difference is that autophagy is basically saving cells from dying, while apoptosis is a mechanism which leads to cell death. So autophagy plays a role in almost all cells. Basically, if you block autophagy for, you know, in a dish just for a few hours, the cell will die. In the human body, the time scale may be longer, simply because we provide cells an ideal environment to live in, but they will die. That's a promise. So yeah, so these are two connected but opposite mechanisms.
Okay. So
autophagy is kind of, it's one of those things that I think you hear a lot about it when it comes to wellness. If you kind of go looking at the right or wrong, perhaps, websites, it's one of those things along with oxidative stress and a lot of things that are quite big buzzwords when it comes to popular health sometimes. So why is that? Like, why is it that autophagy is so far-reaching in terms of the implications between it and health, like from a kind of pop science point of view?
I mean, if you think of our body, it is a machine, right? It's made of different elements, and these elements, well, it's made of different modules, and these modules are, you know, made of different elements and so on. Similar to like how a car is made, right? A car has different modules, and all of those modules have different elements. And in order for the car to run for many years, what do you need to do? You need to service it, and each of those parts has a specific requirement. What is common, well, there are many commonalities as well. For example, if the parts start to rust, you need to deal with the rust, right? But what is rust, actually? It is oxidized, you know, metal, for example, or wasting plastic. Same way in our body, our cells are metabolizing things. What is happening to the byproducts? And these byproducts sometimes can accumulate within the cell. And if they go beyond a certain level, they will start damaging the cell from within. And because the basic mechanism of survival is so common between all cells in our body, irrespective of, you know, their nature and function, autophagy has far-reaching scope in our body just to maintain good health of cells. And it, as I said, it does that by removing whatever waste the cells are producing, and all cells of our body are producing waste, so it needs to be cleared in some way. And autophagy is one way in which waste is cleared. But in addition to that, our body does not live in ideal and optimal homeostatic conditions all the time. So there are situations when we are starving, for example, when we don't have any more glucose left or things like that. And in that case, autophagy kicks in again, and it kind of digests some unwanted materials within the cell so the cell can keep going. It's like cell is feeding on itself from within without requiring any more food from outside. But these are situations of normal health. In cases of disease, autophagy takes a completely different function, and it depends on what kind of disease we are talking about. And oxidative stress, the relationship between oxidative stress and autophagy is through what oxidative stress does to our body, which is basically damaging whatever elements the body is made of, the proteins, the lipids, and so on. And if there is significant amount of damage, then autophagy kicks in and tries to clear out the damaged materials. But as you can imagine, there is an equilibrium between the two. There is some level of oxidative damage going on all the time, and autophagy clearing out things. And with aging and with disease, what happens is antioxidant oxidative stress, for example, can overcome the power of autophagy. And that leads to death of cells and, you know, accumulation of waste and disease progression and so on. So autophagy is kind of very broad, and you can pull it in all different kinds of ways.
From the sounds of it sounds like autophagy simply is like an MOT service for the cell. Like, you've got a wide range of problems that can happen, and autophagy can sort of sort it out.
Yes. Essentially, that's a good way of putting it. It is kind of an MOT. It's like full service. of but we have to be mindful that it is a very tightly regulated process, and it's going on all the time. It's not that we need to check on the cell periodically. We need to check on the cells all the time, and one of the initial steps in autophagy is sensing. So it senses the needs of the cell and it kicks in if required. So that's the difference between MOT service and autophagy.
That's good.
I like the analogy between oxidative stress and rusting as well. I think that's actually like a really good way, I think, for people to visualize kind of what oxidative stress can kind of do. I mean, at the end of the day, it is the oxidization of biomolecules at a small level within cells, just for anybody who isn't quite familiar with what oxidative stress is. So actually thinking about it like rust accumulating is a really good way of visualizing.
I will remember to use it in the class next time.
So we kind of like, we talked a little bit about autophagy being very far-reaching. So why is autophagy the true panacea then? I'm saying that slightly tongue-in-cheek, but why, I guess another way is kind of why wouldn't we kind of think of autophagy just by itself as necessarily the cure to all of our problems?
Two reasons. One, probably we just woke up and realized autophagy is there. But also the attention has been taken up in different parts of the world by other more demanding challenges that the medical sciences had to deal with. And in developing world, I originally come from India. In India, we still are not able to cope with infections. I mean, although penicillin has been around for such a long time, we still are not able to control infections properly. The other thing is, it's always about who is shouting louder. And we, these days in the UK Dementia Research Institute, talk a lot about how insignificant the funding for our research is in comparison to cancer. But if you look at the number of deaths of cancer, it's one third of the number of deaths that are related to Alzheimer's and dementia and so on. But the funding for dementia research is less than one fourth of what has been spent on cancer. So it just doesn't make sense that more people die because of a particular disease, and the cause for that, all those diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, is autophagy, and you're not spending enough money on it. Not to say we shouldn't spend money on cancer and HIV and so on, but you have to be able to gauge the scale of the problem and be able to further our research into that. We haven't been able to do that, but now autophagy was discovered as a mechanism in 1957. But the number of publications have just started rising very steeply from 1990s. And the Nobel Prize for autophagy work was given out in 2016. But there has been very insignificant amount of funding that was spent in understanding the role of autophagy and how we can utilize it to deal with diseases and solve our problems, as you put it.
I think it's quite interesting. I'm currently on my clinical placement in care of the elderly wards. And actually, a lot of the clinicians are encouraging us to get involved in sort of neurodegenerative research, or trying to inspire us into going into that field, because it's quite, I don't think we quite realize how many people are affected. Although lots of people may be dying from cancer or other sorts of illnesses, there's normally comorbidities of dementia or Alzheimer's present within them, these patients. Yes. So it's quite, I think it's going to be a growing specialty and research area.
No, definitely. It's like I was listening to a talk earlier today by somebody called Professor Gregory Potocki, and he he showed a very interesting diagram. He showed that the number of people who are working at any point of time in the past, if you plotted them, you would see it fits like into a pyramid. The number of people working is always larger than the tip of the pyramid, which is basically the number of the aging people. So there's a large number of workforce and large number of people who are working and supporting a very small number of elderly people or diseased people who are not able to work. But now, because of the advancements in science and availability of food and medicine, the number of people who are living longer is increasing, meaning the tip of the pyramid is kind of expanding. So his take on it was that by 2050, it's not going to be a pyramid anymore. The number of people living in elderly age who have retired is going to be similar to, not the same, but similar to the number of people who are working. Mm-hmm. So this is going to create a problem, because now how are we going to support all these people, because they are ill and they need lots of attention and so on. So he makes a case that the only way we can help such a society is by more biomedical research. To try to promote healthy aging, people can self-sustain and take care of themselves and so on. So that this small bottom of the pyramid can still support the ever-expanding top of it. Yes, it is. I believe it needs a lot of attention now, and more discoveries are being made into dementia and neurodegeneration, opening up more and more questions. So a lot more work is required.
I think there's lots of, mostly in mice, to be fair, but there's some quite interesting research that's been done, kind of looking at things like this, and looking at how by targeting like specific genes and kind of specific genetic networks, you can not just prolong the longevity of the mice, but you can also prolong their kind of health period. Mm-hmm. Prolong their kind of the onset of neurodegenerative diseases and cancers and diseases that we typically think of as age related diseases, which is really interesting, and thinking about how that from like a societal point of view in the future and kind of a medical point of view that could be translated into human populations, on the giant caveat of actually managing to do that, taking it from mice to humans. But I think it kind of warrants us to go a little bit deeper then into how autophagy kind of links with neurodegenerative disease. So what really is the link there? Like what's going on in, say, Lewy body dementia or Parkinson's or something like that, that is relevant to autophagy?
So as I just said, but our understanding of autophagy and how it plays a role in cell survival and healthy aging as an outcome is changing all the time. We have now moved on from our one gene, one function theory to something we call polygenic risks. So autophagy depends on the normal functioning of a number of genes. And that's what identification of those genes is, what was recognized by the award of Nobel Prize. But funny enough that when you look in patients who have neurodegeneration, they don't have any mutations in those genes. So our understanding that a mutation in a gene will lead to disease is limited by the fact that we don't find these mutations in these genes. It is most possibly because of the fact, like we see in mice, if you mutate one of these essential genes, they just die. So these people don't exist. It's the same case, like how there's larger number of people with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's compared to ALS, simply because they just don't live that longer. Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, they are diseases of the mind, mostly, or the brain, mostly. Alzheimer's is a disease of the muscles. So as soon as you become ill, you are just counting days. So in terms of autophagy and what we know about it, there's a set of processes that regulate autophagy, and there's a set of processes autophagy regulates. And all of these come together, to manifest in the form of a disease. Now, the number of and the list of genes and proteins that are involved in autophagy, that is increasing all the time. We are discovering more and more genes and proteins that play a role in autophagy. But these proteins, what do they do themselves, as a protein, and how are they linked to autophagy? That's expanding as well. So what we know for now, for example, is our understanding that, we will identify a gene and a mutation in the gene, and we will base our theory that a particular disease is associated with that gene. That is not true anymore. What we are now discovering is that a disease, a disorder, can actually have polygenic origins. And what you also see is that any one of those genes, we're talking of autophagy here, any one of those genes does not lead to disease. So it is a collective effect of quite a few things that comes together to manifest as a disease. And that makes it difficult to target autophagy with drugs and so on, simply because in the past, and this is one of the reasons why most of the clinical trials in the past failed, because you have a drug, it modulates the activity of this protein. For example, let's say that it's a sodium channel, and you made a drug which will make this sodium channel function normally. But what happens as a result is that you have actually ignored everything else that is linked to the functioning of sodium channel. For example, what other protein needs to bind the sodium channel so that it functions normally? All you have done is you have restored the flow of ions through the sodium channel. When you take these drugs into patients, then there is either no effect, or it has detrimental effects, like one of the drugs that was approved for epilepsy long time ago. It was a potassium channel modulator. It proved to be having detrimental effects on the health of the patient, and it was almost immediately discontinued. So we know autophagy just to the extent about what it does. We also know that it is disrupted in a lot of these neurodegenerative diseases. Can we use it to fix these problems? Yes, but how? We don't know. So that is what we need to figure out. How do we use autophagy? What is it that we need to fix about autophagy? And it's no longer the case of designing a drug based on one protein. We need to look at the whole process.
I guess it's like a puzzle piece in that sense, isn't it? So like it's got lots of different edges for that one puzzle piece to work, fit the picture. So that drug needs...
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The reason for that, as I said, is simply because we are discovering more and more components of this puzzle. Yeah. There's more and more parts to it. Long-held theory about, for example, amyloid beta deposition in the brain is getting more and more components added to it. What we knew in the past is that amyloid beta deposition leads to neuronal dysfunction and death of the neuron, and you have a disease. But it's not that simple anymore. So we still can't fix problems that originate as a defect of in autophagy, simply because we just don't know enough about it. And by the time we realize that on the route that we had taken to fix it, it's 12 or 15 years, and then the drug fails. So what do you do? You go back, and that's always not possible to do. So now the research into autophagy and how we can use it is diversifying, and there are many different ways and many different things that need to be taken into account, and that is happening now. So I'm quite hopeful.
So we were just discussing how autophagy could be used as a way of treating various neurodegenerative degenerative conditions. I was just wondering, is autophagy then both a causative and a protective factor, or which one is it?
So autophagy defect is a cause for the diseases that we see. And this has been derived by research in laboratories where we look at individual cells or animal models, where you can disrupt the process of autophagy. And you see similar effects that we see in patients. You see similar symptoms that we see in patients. You see at the cellular level, similar mechanisms, or for example, deposition of proteins or deposition of waste in the cells that you see in patients. That kind of leads us to believe that autophagy defect is a cause for the disease. But there is also this other notion, and there is quite a good amount of support for it, that once the disease has been triggered, it leads further damage to the process of autophagy, the cellular mechanisms that lead the disease. So it feeds back into itself. So that leads to further further progression of disease and quickens the progress into advanced stages of disease.
So are there any kind of specific neurodegenerative conditions that we've found that are linked to autophagy at the moment?
Yes, there's quite a large list of them. I work in the Dementia Research Institute, and we are particularly interested in diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, which have a dementia component to it.
Right.
There is lots of other diseases. There's a Gaucher's disease and Newman-Pick's disease, and all of these. They all have an autophagy component to it. And autophagy, we haven't yet talked about it. Autophagy is classified into many different kinds. For example, autophagy of mitochondria, autophagy of endoplasmic reticulum, and so on. And these processes, they differ from each other in terms of what genes are involved in carrying out. For example, it's not the same number of genes that is involved for mitochondrial autophagy that is required for endoplasmic reticulum autophagy. Yeah. Okay, so the set of genes, they have a large set of overlapping genes, but there are some things which are specific to mitochondria and they are not necessary for endoplasmic reticulum. And what we are trying to do is just focus on diseases which have a dementia component to it, and Alzheimer's disease stands out for that because it has the largest rate of dementia incidences related to it. And in fact, the goal of the institute is to have some kind of a therapeutic advancement by 2025, which is a very ambitious goal. A lot of progress is being made currently. So there is quite a number of diseases that have autophagy as a basic mechanism which causes them.
That's really interesting. I mean, 2025, that's what, 4 years away now? But I think that's nearly like a motivating factor, isn't it?
To have
so close, like you want to reach there with something significant. So I think that's exciting. I'll definitely keep on. Sure.
No, definitely. We must, though, differentiate the understanding of that deadline from a layman's understanding, which is which dementia are you treating, which part of the pathway are you treating, are you able to treat, for example, all the patients with dementia? That's not going to be possible. But if we take a small subset of patients who have a dementia and they have a common cause for dementia, we might have developed a treatment by then. At least be very close to that. So there's a program called Race Against Dementia, and it provides funding to young scientists like myself to kind of make progress quickly enough to be able to deal with this problem.
I want to paint a picture of where autophagy kind of fits in a picture of, let's say, Parkinson's or something like that, and then you can critique me on it and tell me if, okay, I'm right or not. But just for, like we said, like a layman's perspective, so like we were talking about before, like we can think of lots of process of damage mm-hmm. in a cell as being kind of like rusting, you know, like the rust kind of clumps up. And I guess you can kind of think of autophagy then a bit like vinegar. If you wanted to get rid of that rust, obviously you need something that's going to break it apart and send it on its way. And the process of autophagy through lysosomes and everything like that can kind of come along and break those clumps up and pump them out. And, you know, they're not going to cause problems anymore, hopefully. And so in terms of how that links into neurodegenerative diseases, obviously a lot of these diseases like Alzheimer's, like Parkinson's, they're Huntington's as well, potentially even aging itself, which I do want to talk about in a sec, can be almost classified by these builds up of different types of rust within the cell. So am I right in thinking that autophagy kind of come along, clear these blocks up, send them on their way, and then theoretically make everything better?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
If the cell has
absolutely correct. The only thing I would add in here is the kind of rust that we have within the cell, it varies. And although we say autophagy as if it is one process, it can be divided into many different processes, but it does the same job. It clears up the mess. And the reason why we haven't been able to use it as a magic way of treating all the diseases is to know how much of cleaning is good for you. And cleaning is called cleaning only so far as it's clearing out the mess. But if you go into overdrive and you start throwing out the furniture from your room or from your home, it is a kind of cleaning, but it's not beneficial anymore. So to have that right balance is really true for autophagy as well. Because there are diseases where too much autophagy is a problem, and it helps the disease progression.
I had this image earlier when we were talking about kind of like drugs that can modulate these processes. I just had this image of somebody kind of like rolling around, being like, "I'm being eaten alive because you've, you know, stimulated too much autophagy, and they're digesting themselves and." You know, something like that. It's almost like we've taken a step too far.
Exactly. But also, as I said in the beginning, autophagy, when it digests these waste materials, the products that it generates is basically building blocks for, say, lipids and proteins again. So the cell kind of recycles a lot of that. And now in cancers, what happens is that you have autophagy in a not an overdrive, but at a level where actually it is feeding proliferation of cells. So it's not always beneficial to have too much autophagy. We don't know whether autophagy overstimulation can lead to cancer, but we know that the autophagy levels are higher in cancers. So we have to be cautious about, you know, what we are doing with it. How much do we crank it up or down?
There's also that link between, you know, mTOR and autophagy. Obviously, mTOR being a very kind of prolific cancer gene, there is that direct link between autophagy and mTOR and mTOR inhibiting autophagy. So as we can think about that as well.
Yes. I mean, mTOR is the master regulator, we call it, of autophagy. There have been attempts to target mTOR. There is rapamycin, which is still used in clinics. But it's not used to treat dementias and so on. And rapamycin basically inhibits the activity of mTOR, and you have increases in autophagy. But it hasn't been really, really successful in the clinic yet. But yeah, mTOR is a master regulator. It's really at the top of autophagy.
We talked about overstimulation of autophagy, or like the degradation of autophagy. Have we yet identified what can cause that, like what are risk factors for causing or inducing overstimulation of autophagy?
this is a great question, and I love it. Simply because you know, when we talk of autophagy and when we talk of dementia and when we talk of all these diseases, especially in the cases of neurodegeneration and Alzheimer's disease, for example, let's say, a very small proportion of cases actually are caused by, you know, genetic changes, mutations and genes and so on. So the current estimate is only 10% of the cases are actually familial, okay, which have a genetic cause. And I was talking to someone a few days ago about, we haven't really reached that stage that we can talk about the other 90% of the cases. Yeah. What about them? What about the sporadic cases? So we don't really understand that fully. And one of my long-term interests in studying autophagy is and neurodegeneration, degenerative diseases, to study the epigenetic factors, the environmental factors, the factors which are not genetic as such. Like there is no mutation that is required for this, but you still see a change in autophagy or change in cell survival rate and so on. So we haven't identified every single thing that is necessary for autophagy. There are continuously discoveries being made, but the latest newest platform of discovery is looking at polygenetic risks for developing diseases, and there have been recently a couple of very interesting articles where they said actually, I think it was 90% or 95%, with 95% confidence, we can predict if somebody's going to develop Alzheimer's just by looking at their polygenic scores. 95% is a huge number. But again, this has some genetic element. We are looking at genes that are up or down regulated. We are looking at polymorphisms in small nucleotide polymorphisms in the genes. These are not essentially mutations within the gene and the coding frame. They are elsewhere. And on their own, they don't do anything. It's only when these three or four SNPs come together and they sit in different genes that you are more likely to get Alzheimer's. Although the case for studying individual genes and mutations is still valid, but now there is more and more noise in the scientific community that we should look at multigenic risks and pathways and mechanisms.
We can't really, one topic that I'm very keen to discuss, that I think we can't really talk about neurodegenerative disease without talking about aging. And a lot of what we've been talking about, you know, we've discussed the implications of an aging population, but I still think the elephant in the room is, where does autophagy fit in with aging? And especially within the kind of picture of aging as a disease?
Well, it's a difficult question to ask. Aging is not a consequence of autophagy alone. It is a consequence of a lot of wear and tear that goes down in the genome and in the proteome of a person or his life. To make things even more complex, we have new studies which show how our microbiome, you know, the bacteria that live in our body, how they change and contribute to development of disease and aging. And our lifestyle has a huge impact on all of it. And autophagy plays a very small role in aging. And what we know now is that you can delay aging, or you can have a healthy kind of aging if you have moderately good levels of autophagy. A compromised autophagy level definitely brings on the symptoms of aging quite early on. But one-to-one relationship between a gene and aging is yet to come. We just know that with age, levels of autophagy go down. The accumulation of waste is higher. The robustness of cells, you know, the fit for survival levels of cells goes down. But the contributing factor is not only aging, which means if, for example, you came up with a wonder drug which stimulates autophagy, will you be able to prevent aging? And in a sense, that's really not going to happen. The reason for that is there is other contributory factors as well. Now, like I said, the multigenic origins of disease, aging is a multifactorial outcome. It has many contributing factors to it. And one of them is our lifestyle. And I would tie in, you know, your job, the stress levels, the anxiety, the bodily physical strain that you have put on yourself, your food habits. What do you eat? So you can't be eating the same food throughout your life and expect to be living the same, you know, age life or age, be arrested at a particular age simply because the requirement of our body changes over time. So autophagy is important in aging, but not the way we as a layman might think about it as if it is a cause for aging or it can fix aging. That's not the understanding currently about it.
I think that's like a $1 million question, isn't it? How do we stop aging? Because I think everyone, like, you see so many products out there, and there's so much advice regarding like vitamin supplements and like creams and so on and so forth as to like how do we stop aging, and people are always after that goal. So it's really interesting that there that link between aging and, I suppose, autophagy. Yeah. I was wondering about, kind of, you mentioned food. Is there a link between autophagy and food?
No, of course there is. Yes. So one of the sensors for stimulation of autophagy is a cyclic AMP, which is related to glucose metabolism. So autophagy is quite early on today. I mentioned that autophagy helps cells deal with stress, and one of those stresses is starvation. So starvation meaning low availability of glucose, meaning low availability of cyclic AMP, and that stimulates autophagy. So the quality of food, how much you ate and what you ate, actually determines, what's going to happen to autophagy. In fact, if you were to look for healthy aging, most of the advice you will find these days is starvation. You know, fasting, like intermittent fasting and so on. And that is simply to allow your body to deal with whatever waste was produced, from your last eating and from your last eating until the time you end your fasting. So it is one of the mechanisms. If you overload your body with food, then, that's going to have a detrimental effect on autophagy. So yes, so there is a link. That's not the only link, but that.
I guess my question was: Is it possible for healthy aging to actually happen? Because, from my understanding, part of aging is the decrease of autophagy, which by decreasing autophagy, you're more at risk of getting diseases and accumulation of waste products, etc. So. In theory, I can understand that it does work, but is it physically possible for to have healthy aging?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge here is that our bodies differ from the car that we talked about in the beginning. We know about all the components of the car. We know exactly when it needs oil. We know exactly when it needs petrol or diesel. We know exactly when it needs water and so on. The problem with ourselves is that our bodies, they differ from each other. So there is no one-size-fits-all kind of approach we could take. We can just say in a majority of the population, this is what works. But is it going to work for you? Maybe not. But there are generalizations which can be made. On the basis of a large sample of people that you can look at. And one of the things that we know for sure is that optimal autophagy levels do help your body stay a bit younger and healthier and so on. But that, how do you achieve that? And how much do you crank it up or crank it down? That is a problem. So there's new research now. It was out in the last 4 or 5 days, which showed that if you know too much exercise actually reduces the ability of mitochondria to carry out its energy producing capability normally. So until now, what we have been believing is that you exercise a lot, meaning and then give your body some rest. And you know, you will stay young forever. But what this new study says is that initially, when you start getting up into your exercise regime, you have some benefits of exercise on mitochondrial activity. But as you go deeper and deeper and you increase the goals of your exercise, mitochondrial activity doesn't really, go up anymore. So it doesn't really go hand in hand. So how much is the question? How much autophagy? How much fasting? How much food? That's the question. And that differs between people. Now, you might see some people claim, oh, this is what I did all my life. That's how I lived for 120 years. Well, it worked for you. Will it work for every other individual or not? And that's why we need to understand the individuals as individuals, rather than how we used to have, one-size-fit-all kind of strategies, give the same medicine to everybody at the same dose. And,
I think it's really interesting to think about it from that point of view of different things kind of apply at different points in your life. I think one thing to add to what you said, and then I'll make another point, but to add to that is, I guess it's not just about what autophagy is doing. It's also about, you could have your autophagy remain constant throughout your entire lifespan, but if the amount of oxidative phosphorylation and other kind of post-translational modifications are being done to proteins that are causing them to clump up, other kinds of just cellular metabolic stress, autophagy could stay constant, but it can't deal with increased levels of that stress. So I guess that's kind of where lifestyle comes into it as well, is that if you aren't kind of, I guess, I don't want to say optimizing your lifestyle, but if you aren't maybe making the whatever the right lifestyle choices are, you could be increasing the buildup of those products while, your autophagy could be going on perfectly happily and nothing's wrong with it. So I guess that's one thing to think about as well. But one of the concepts that was brought up in Life Ascending, I will sing the praise of this book because, I found it fascinating. Like, it really opened my eyes to a lot of things. But one of the things they talk about is when you think of longevity from the point of view of like natural selection, if you look at kind of the way that lifespan, how you kind of determine an organism's lifespan, almost always you can kind of measure lifespan as a function of the time it takes for that organism to reach sexual maturity, and especially to leave sexual maturity. So while, lots of different organisms, lots of different sizes and stuff have very different lifespans, the ratio between sexual reproductive age and total lifespan is quite similar between lots and lots of organisms. So it kind of raises the idea that natural selection only has to get us to the point where we can finish mating. After that, it's kind of a free-for-all, because we obviously at that point, the only value that we really have in a natural selection point of view is helping the organisms that can reproduce. But in terms of us actually contributing to the gene pool, we're not really doing anything at that point. So they raise this kind of concept of genes that may help us reach sexual maturity and may be beneficial for us to reach sexual maturity and be competitive in reproducing, may in the long term detriment us, because that it doesn't matter at that point. If you die once you're past sexual maturity, from a natural selection point of view, it doesn't matter. Like, you've served your purpose. I know it sounds kind of wrong, but I think that's really interesting from the point of view of autophagy as well, because like you're talking about, what is healthy when you're young doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy when you're old as well, because nobody was made to get that old, really. And evolution is not on your side once you reach that point. So we kind of, I think, have to think differently about how we approach that. And that's where I think some of this autophagy stuff can be interesting. Like, I talked earlier about that study in mice, but I think one of the things they did was actually give those mice rapamycin, just give them rapamycin and also SIRT1
yes.
agonist, I think. Because obviously sirtuins are like a big thing when we're talking about sure. kind of calorie restriction and stuff. And by doing that, they prolonged not just longevity, but also health span significantly. So yeah, I know you said that we can't really just give a drug and everybody's going to live for 150 years and not get cancer until 120. But what do you think about that? I guess it kind of ties into the question of what are the difficulties in scaling up these kind of cellular metabolic processes, like very fundamental micro scale things like autophagy, to actually making a kind of functional clinical treatment plan. What are some of the issues that we have to deal with in kind of getting from there that we're inevitably going to encounter over the next 30, 40
No, I think, I mean, I agree with what you said. It's kind of, like I said before, you can have some generalizations in by looking at a large, you know, population set and say, well, this is what works. Is it a guarantee that every person who walks in the clinic and you gave them this magic drug, can you guarantee that this person is going to be helped by the drug? That's a million-dollar question again, right? So what's happening now in science is there's more and more emphasis on looking at all aspects of a disease, for example. Looking at the individual's genetic makeup, looking at the profession of the individual. I mean, you'll be surprised to see that just by providing education to people, you reduce their risks of developing dementia. Just by, you know, so imagine how unequal our society is, even in those terms. Some people are. They drop out, you know, quite early on in their schools, while as others go on to, you know, have PhDs and become professors. So how do you then differentiate between these two unless you have a proper understanding of these individuals and their, you know, the holistic approach? So a long time ago, there was a report published where they actually looked at throughout the world in the oldest people that lived. And then they looked at what is common between these people. And there were some generalizations, and they still hold true. One of them was these people were quite social. Okay. We know the impact of being social on your health. And these people were quite social. The other thing, most of these people came from very poor countries or countries where the lifestyle is very simple, like in Japan. They don't eat a lot of meat, for example. So they ate a lot of fibrous food, you know, and they were very active in their life. So there was some generalization, and we know that these things really are important. An active person is much better off in terms of, you know, kind of guaranteed life, a longer, a few more years in life than a person who is sedentary and not moving. So there are generalizations. So what we are trying to do now in science is, you know, try to understand an individual and his requirements for treatment if they become ill, but also for healthy aging and having a healthy lifestyle, the advice will be different between different individuals. So what's happening in at least I know of University of Sheffield is they're trying to they've come up with the idea of having digital twins of people. So a digital twin of you is basically all the information about you. And it will inform what kind of diseases you are predisposed to have, to develop, you know, over the next years. The advice that you'll be given will be according to, you know, what has been fed into the digital twin. So the it's not about now, you know, like in the past, you used to have a cut on your body and you go to the doctor and he will stitch it up and give you penicillin. That's not the case anymore. You have a cut on your body. They won't know whether it is just a simple cut or you have a problem with your skin. They also want to know whether you are diabetic, for example. in the past, they wouldn't worry about that, right? So your medication is going to be more and more tailor-made. And same is the advice for healthy aging. I was going to come back to Halima's question. For healthy aging as well, the advice has to be tailor-made. I mean, for example, the simplest, the crudest way of looking at it is, can you give the same advice to the man and the woman? No. They are genetically different. Their requirement is different to stay healthy. So this holistic approach is what is required in future rather than...
I think what was quite interesting, linking drug. Back to Sam's earlier point about how different points at your life, you need different things. I think an interesting study that's often mentioned is about athletes. You know, the excess amount of exercise that they do is obviously healthy for their general health, but closer look and inspection progressively as they age, they're noticing left ventricular hypertrophy and the complications of that, whether they have heart failure or etc. And so I think it's quite interesting when you talk about healthy aging, tailoring it to each individual, because I think the aim of any clinician, we all say, is to, it's all got to be patient-centered. So from the sounds of it, autophagy and the research that's going into it is ensuring it's more streamlining for patient-centered care.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, credit does go to Samuel saying, you know, that the requirements of individuals change over a period of time in their life as they change with who they are, and all that we the scientists, the current batch of scientists, are able to do is try to identify who you are and tailor medication to that. We really haven't reached the stage where we can tailor it to the different stages of your life, for example. We are still trying to to determine your genetic identity, and the contribution of your genetic identity to you, for example, developing a disease or being predisposed to disease. And that's where, you know, like I mentioned early on, now we don't believe in the one gene disease theory anymore. We now are thinking of diseases as being an output of many contributing factors. And when I say factors, I am particularly talking about genetic factors.
I think it also raises like this. We actually talked about this in our first guest episode. But the notion of it kind of almost going back to my own question, when we think about how do we target these kind of very small scale cellular metabolic activity things, it's almost that the more we find out, the more we realize we already knew. It's like if you talk to somebody like how do you optimize autophagy, how do you enable healthy aging, and it always comes back to eat a healthy diet, get lots of sleep, exercise. It's like things that we've had like hammered on us for ages and ages and ages. And we can think of all the different drugs that we could use to promote autophagy and reduce kind of cancerous growth and things like that. You know,
no, obviously, obviously. I mean, I 100% agree. Although I would say that the assumption there again is that if you do these things, they're going to benefit everybody equally, which is really not the case, because now with the changing, you know, circumstances, changing world and development and so on, we are, you know, going really far away from the lifestyle that we used to have, you know, to which, you know, we will generally talk about. But what we have now since, I mean, just think of last 1 year. How much change has been there just in the last 1 year? People are just working at home. Imagine it's not only about working at home. It's about everything else has now changed in their life. They don't get up and dress up as they used to. They don't eat the breakfast at the time when they would normally eat it. They are surrounded by other people all the time if they don't live in a 6-bedroom house. So all those things, they become part of you, and they are what will be required to build a digital twin of you. But yes, certain things are always going to be true. For example, getting enough sleep, always true. But what do you do with people who have to work, night shifts? What do you do about doctors who are, on a rota? These are the people who are going to fall ill, at a higher frequency than other people. And at that time, we need to be able to intervene. And that's why we need to understand them. What did they do? What is their genetic makeup? How is it that, what age are they? What sex are they? So we need to understand all of those factors in order to. And then on top of that, the cause of disease is not always the same, right? So the cause of defect in autophagy, for example, is not always the same. So you need to understand the cause of autophagy defect in a particular individual and then give him treatment according to that. So paracetamol works for all, is true only to a certain extent, but we have to go beyond that.
I guess it's kind of, yeah, like how on the one hand we can think of, we can be healthy, but also a lot of our development in medicine is how can we be unhealthy and still maintain health? Like, I see your point that kind of, it's hard in modern society to not work a very strenuous job. How can we kind of intervene in that and kind of get the benefits that we would get from living a healthy life without actually having to live a healthy life, if you get what I mean? Like, that is kind of the difficult, how do we enable that? And I think that is kind of, in a way, it's quite a tragic goal, but it's like a
two objective goal. One is obviously to help people who have fallen sick because of no fault of their own, but also to, for example, I mean, it's a crude example again, but to help people work night shifts and not fall ill.
Yeah.
Right. So you are helping people who are actually following the right regime and eating the right food, but they fall ill because of their genetic makeup, for example. They have a mutation. But you have this other group of people, they are healthy otherwise, but they don't have a choice. They have to, they don't have a healthy lifestyle simply because they're forced into it. Yeah. And now you want to ensure that they live healthy, or they live disease-free and fix their problems if you can.
I think it's all about... It's the whole thing between correlation and causation, like the difference between the two, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like, you really have to kind of draw the line and not confuse the two, which I think a lot of people do automatically, and especially with things like, so like the digital twin sounds amazing, but I think it'd be easy to draw correlations between a population group rather than pinning down that causation. And then that's the difficult question, isn't it? I think, and that's what we're after.
I think as well, like, I was expecting to go in this direction, but I guess maybe in 30, 40 years' time, our lecturers cannot expect us to sleep at all, and they'll just give us a rapamycin pill or something, and then we'll have you to thank, Bilal, because
it is pioneered our... it is. It is a very interesting question, and I have a lot of thought, lots of thoughts on it. One of them is take out what is redundant and not required, and that will lessen the pressure on people a lot. For example, here it is already it's gone, but in India, for example, we used to write a lot just to improve our handwriting. Okay, so it was one of the goals of writing was to improve your handwriting, but do you care anymore? You don't, right? Same way, things that you're taught right now, the modules that are designed right now, they should also take into account that some of this stuff used to be taught in 1950s and actually is not required anymore. So that will definitely lessen the burden on future students. But also, I think there is more and more technological help available now. So we don't really need to kill the students anymore.
A big thank you to Dr. Malik for joining us on today's episode. We'll be sure to leave a link to his 2019 publication that summarizes autophagy and some of the things we've talked about today in a little bit more detail for those who are interested. I think we've had a really good discussion today that provides a concise introduction to the topic of autophagy and the links to neurodegenerative diseases and aging. There's a lot more to explore within this topic, which we very much encourage you to do in your own time. But today has emphasized how autophagy may be relevant to medicine in the future and even now, but also some of the difficulties of translating biomolecular research into functional clinical medicine.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our social media. We've been Ellie, Sam, Natasha and Talima bringing you another episode of the Inspire Podcast. Please like or follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter at Inspire Journal Podcast and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify or any other podcasting platform. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue to bring you the content that you love. We really are passionate about research and we'd love this podcast to reach as many people as possible, so please share with your friends and on social media. The Inspire Podcast is brought to you by the Inspire Student Journal. You can visit our journal website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk to find out more. See you next time.
We're students and we're all still learning, so we appreciate any comments, feedback or error corrections in relation to the topics discussed. All research presented is correct at the time of recording. Any medical information provided does not constitute official medical advice. Consult your own physician for any medical issues that you may be experiencing. Views expressed in the Inspired Journal podcast are of the hosts and guests and do not represent the views of the Inspired Student Journal or of the institutions we are attached to.